Hey, I'm glad you're listening. Raw is free. It's going to be. But it's not cheap. There's a lot of research and emotion that goes into getting these great stories of the Bible. And it demands from me one of the most limited resources I have these days, which is my time. Not money, but time. There's a lot of things I want to do, a lot of things I want to make. I'm not just talking about putting my feet up. I'm talking about writing books and designing t-shirts and all sorts of fun stuff coming your way. So do me a favor. If you do think this is a valuable thing that I'm doing, will you at least leave me a 5-star review over on iTunes or share it on your favorite social network outlet? Or, well, you could do me a real one and subscribe over there on Patreon. Because I promise, the more support I get from you, the more cool stuff I can turn around and send back your way again. Thanks for listening. Let me explain. No, second thought. There is too much. Let me sum up. Tribulation. Palm branches. Leviticus. Mattathias. Judas Maccabeus. Now, if none of that made any sense to you, you need to go listen to the last episode. Yeah, you need to go pick that up. I mean, I can tell you that the Great Tribulation is the present age we live in, the fall, waiting for Christ's return, from which we have been redeemed by the work of Jesus. I can tell you that the people waved palm branches on the day that Jesus entered Jerusalem, and that makes no sense whatsoever, because the only reference to palm branches, really, that would have anything to do with this in the Bible is from Leviticus, and it's all about the Feast of Booths, which is not the festival Jesus was entering into Jerusalem for. He was entering for the Feast of Passover. And I can tell you that to try to understand this, because there is an answer to it. We've gone way back into the dark corners of the intertestamental period to the book of Daniel and the prophecy of the fall of Alexander the Great and the fight between the various kingdoms that split out of his empire, which boils down to the Seleucids and the Ptolemies, which is basically Mesopotamia and Egypt, but ruled by these Greek dynasties, these Greek family lines. And that one of these descendants named Antiochus IV, who calls himself God Manifest, Epiphanes, but who his people call Epinani, the mad one, he is busy trying to expand his empire by unifying it around a religion, which means he's going to make things really hard on the Jews. And this eventually leads to a revolt, an uprising under the leadership of a guy named Mattathias, who, as he gets this guerrilla war going, seems to have some success with it. Antiochus is actually off in the east trying to get taxes for other reasons and whatnot, and his battle with Egypt wasn't really going so well. So it's not like he's got the full attention focused down on Judea. So the guerrilla warfare gets going pretty well. Mattathias is leading it. He's rallying people to him. They're doing a hit and run, kind of sack the city, throw down the idol's altar, and then go back and hide in the mountains and the hills again thing. And then he's an old man, and so it's too much for him. And he's about to die. And as he's about to die, he looks to his 5 sons who've been in this with him all along. And he says, look, you're all good kids, but Judas, my 3rd-born, Judas, which is in no way a traitor's name, has no reference to darkness, is actually really connected to Judea, right? Judah. The tribe that more or less still exists because of the return from exile to this spot, although this family, Mattathias' family, the Asmonean line, is part of the Levitical family, and even the Aaronic family, because they're priests. Judas, my 3rd-born, in the lineage of priests, you are a warrior, if there ever was one. So as I die, you take up this fight. After all, from your youth, we have misnamed you. We've always called you, since you were a boy, Maccabeus, the hammer. So, great hammer, lead this people and bring back the name of God in our land. Now, the first thing you're going to find, if you try to go and study this intertestamental period and the time of the Maccabees, you're going to find a lot of misinformation, a lot of different information. It's obscure. It's not all clear. Some of it's from 1st and 2nd Maccabees and 3rd Maccabees and 4th Maccabees, which aren't as reliable as 1st and 2nd Maccabees. Some of it is from various other historical accounts that we know about what's going on around them. Some of it certainly is in question. Almost nobody, including, you know, the Roman Catholic scholars of old that probably have the highest view of the apocryphal texts, 1st and 2nd Maccabees, almost nobody calls them inspired and inerrant. And the Lutheran fathers certainly didn't. They considered them useful reading, and particularly for this reason, like what we're doing right now, there is history here. And I promise, by the end of this hour, there's going to be palm branches here, too. How, why, when? Well, we're going to try to get there and try to show how this is also about understanding what it means to be brought out of the Great Tribulation. So, but what this means is, as I'm telling this story, I am pulling from a number of different places, Wikipedia included, not for the Maccabees so much, but for some of the other Roman political stuff. I am pulling from the Concordia Publishing House Apocrypha Lutheran Edition with notes, but particularly an addition that is in the front of the book called The Historical Setting of the Apocrypha by Raymond F. Serberg, revised by Edward A. Engelbrecht in view of recent scholarship. I'm relying on this for a lot, but I mean, we're going to actually get to some of the text too. My point in this is I'm going to try to put the pieces together for you in such a way that you don't have to go doing the reading yourself. And if you do go doing the reading yourself, I'm just giving you a fair warning. It's not the easiest puzzle to put together. But once you see the picture, I mean, I think it's stunning. I mean, it's almost something I just want to spend more time on. But let's just start with, though. So Mattathias, he names Judas, who they call the Hammer, to be the leader of his five sons and this rebellion and war for purification. Remember that, war for purification of Israel. This all starts because they're being compelled to sacrifice on false altars. And that an altar has been set up in the Jerusalem temple area, the temple that was rebuilt by Ezra, Nehemiah, Zerubbabel, and Joshua. It's all been desecrated. And so they're taking up arms in the name of being like Joshua of old, in the name of being like Zimri of old. And in 166 BC, the mantle passes. And Judas, for as little as we know about him, Maccabeus, I just call him Maccabeus. Maccabeus, for his, the hammer, for as little as we know about him, we know this much. The guy was a pretty competent military commander. Mattathias made a good decision here. He does manage to rally people to his cause so that as Apollonius, the guy who was the governor of Samaria on behalf of Antiochus IV, right? As he begins to try to squash this little rebellion and do something about it, well, he gets a bloody nose. Judas is able to really push back quite a bit. And he defeats another governor from the region as well, Seron, the governor of Coele-Syria. But above even these guys is yet another name, a guy who is a satrap. Now remember this, the Seleucids think they're Persia. They think they're Cyrus the Great's empire, kind of. They're pretending to be. And so they're using some of the language. So remember, satraps, this is what Daniel got made, a ruler of rulers, right? Those who were over all the edges of the empire. Well, there's a satrap named Lysias. And Lysias is sort of in charge of watching everything while Epiphanes is out doing his own thing. And so he sends another guy named Nicanor against Judas Maccabeus. And Nicanor is a big part of the storyline. He won't matter quite as much for us today, but his name could come up again here. And keep in mind, I mean, some of this history is disputed as to like how much or how little, but that's not really, I mean, something happened. And that's really all that we need for truth at this point. So the Maccabeans are hiding in the Judean hillside and Nicanor comes against them. What, 50,000 men? 7,000 infantry. You know, the more that I listen to other kinds of history, scholars are always debating over how big or how small these armies actually were. But the point is, Judas has a very much smaller force than them, and he pulls kind of a sweet end around. So they're up in the hills, and Nicanor's got his camp, and Nicanor goes with a chunk of his military up into the hills to look for Judas. And while Nicanor is thus distracted, Judas comes out of the hills and attacks the camp and kind of routs it. So then Nicanor has to kind of run away with a significant loss to his troops. So as the army flees, I mean, Judas sees quite a bit of success then continuing to take over smaller targets in that area. extending Jewish dominion even into Philistia, and definitely taking Jerusalem back. And we'll come back and talk about that in a little bit. Other Jews start reaching out to him, asking for help. He sends his brothers Jonathan and Simon, big names from later in the story, to help out with a military force, and it works out. So he just gets more and more confident. He starts making excursions into Edom. Right, this is the ancient descendants of Esau, who were part of the destruction of Jerusalem back during the Babylonian assault, right? Remember that? Well, Judas subjugates them to himself. And in the meantime, Antiochus Epiphanes, well, he dies, 164 BC. He dies maybe in battle, maybe not. You know, Maccabees, the book tells it like is from God. God killed him. God smote him down. I don't know. But it leads to a bit of an upheaval. Because he, right before he dies, gives his empire to his 7-year-old son. And that's kind of the way it had been going on for the Seleucids. It was passed down directly. And that guy's name is Antiochus V, or Eupator. And he will have some power later. But he's only 7, and so he's given to the general, whose name is Philip. So you got to think about what this means, though, for Lysias, right? Here's a guy who's in charge of a large segment of the empire, who suddenly has his emperor, the one over him, dead. And what does he have an opportunity to do? He has an opportunity to actually become the emperor, or to seize power. But the power of name is in the hands of a rival of his, a general, somebody with military might. And so he figures, look, I got to get ready to fight this guy, Philip, because it's between him and me right now to see who's going to be in charge of this thing. So he tries to placate Judas Maccabeus a little bit. He wants to reach out and form a treaty with him. But then Judas, you know, who's been riding high, he goes and attacks a citadel, a castle that's overlooking the Temple Mount. The Romans have the same kind of thing you hear about in the Book of Acts, where the barracks is right there when the riot starts and everyone's trying to kill Paul, right? And they come out and they take him into the barracks. It's like built right onto where the temple would be. In any case, you know, Maccabeus attacking forces Lysias to defend his country. So he comes down against Jerusalem with 100,000 foot soldiers, 20,000 horsemen. Now, maybe those numbers are a little inflated. I don't know. But 32 elephants. And I don't care if it was 32, 24, or 5,000. It's elephants. This is a big deal. And you know it's a big deal because Eleazar, the elder brother of Judas Maccabeus, he's crushed by an elephant. And in the ancient world, especially the Seleucids and the Persians, I mean, making use of elephants in war, this was huge. I mean, horses just can't stand up to these things. They're tanks. Right? You get up on an elephant, nobody can touch you. I mean, yeah, they can shoot at you, but it's pretty intense. So the Maccabean forces, they retreat into the city. They use the temple as a fortress. They shut the doors. And does this sound familiar? Does this sound at all like what happened to Hezekiah? Or conversely, what happened to both Jehoiachin and Zedekiah? And come to think of it, it happened to Manasseh too. And does it sound anything like what happened in 70 AD when Titus brings the Roman armies against Jerusalem and tears it down bit by bit? Now here's the thing. So to Zedekiah, it was torn down, right? And the tribulation was so great, none like it has ever been or will be again, according to the prophets. And in 70 AD, it was so great against the Zealots and their abomination of desolation, which was bringing the Idumeans, that's those Edomites that we were just talking about, right, a little bit ago, bringing those children of Esau into the temple, and they end up destroying, you know, killing some of the priests and all that, right? There's never been a tribulation like this or ever will be again. Both of these things are pictures of the great tribulation, which is the fall of mankind, leading to our restoration in Jesus. But there will never be in eternity another tribulation, anything like what we are enduring here, right? In the middle of all this. And here it is happening again in the intertestamental period to a people who are wanting to be Joshua and Hezekiah, but who aren't always exactly being Joshua and Hezekiah. And one thing is just certainly missing so far from this. They have no prophets with them. They have nobody telling them to do this. And that's going to come up here again in a moment. I don't want to say these men are bad men. But I mean, well, when Mattathias, you know, murders the guy at the altar, it wasn't exactly good. But notice the overlap. And how much must Judas have felt like Hezekiah when Lysias, standing there with 100,000 foot soldiers and 32 elephants at the walls of the Jerusalem gates, is called away? Run along home, Rabshakeh. He's called away because Philip is getting closer, this other guy who's contending with him for the control of the empire. Philip is getting closer. So he rushes off to engage Philip and contend for the powers of the Seleucid kingdom. Before he goes, he offers a treaty. He's like, look, I can't come back and deal with you guys. I don't care. You're really not a big deal to me. Here, let me give you the rights to worship according to your own laws. Let me give you, Judas, come down. You get a full pardon. You got to pay us taxes, but otherwise, you know, you guys are good. You're clear. But the one thing we're going to say is we need to appoint your high priest because we need to know he's not a radical. We need to know he's not a zealot. So we're going to appoint this guy named Jachim. We call him Alchemist. We like his Greek name better, but we're going to make him high priest. He's of Aaronic stock. He's pro-Syria, but he's of Aaronic stock. So, you know, it's all according to the law. It's all good. And Judas, like, sitting up on the walls, like, well, God's answered my prayer. I'm just like Hezekiah. This is great, right? Sure thing. Now, there's one small problem. Because Alchemist is not really a solid dude, this decision costs Judas. He loses the support of the Kasadim. Now, keep these guys in mind. I think we mentioned them last time, although it may have been by a different name. But the Kasadim was these are those who are zealous for the purity of Israel. And they're average people that are coming to join the military cause because of their devotion to the Old Testament laws and the traditions of the elders. Does that ring a bell? Right? The Kasadim, the holy ones. These guys are going to stick around and go back and forth for a little while in terms of their allegiance, but they're always allegiant to the law, the Torah of God. No matter what else is going on politically, no matter what it means for them personally. And these are the spiritual forefathers of the Pharisaic movement. And when they see this kind of halfway high priest put in charge, they now lose respect for Maccabeus. And they stop supporting him, so his army really, really shrinks. Now, in the meantime, Lysias has defeated Philip in battle and now has charge of the ward, Antiochus V, you know, this kid emperor. But something happens to him. We haven't talked much about Rome yet. At this time, and Rome's history is just huge and fascinating, and I can't give you all of it, obviously, but at this time, Rome is run by a Senate. They're a powerful machine. They're militarily very strong, and they kind of see themselves like the United States does today. They're sort of the protector of freedom. And they don't want anybody else getting too big, even though they're not really, you know, super big themselves yet. They're going to get there. So they hear that Antiochus is keeping more warships and elephants than is allowed by a treaty that was made with the Seleucids in 188 BC. And they send an embassy to deal with this and attempt to cripple the Seleucid military by sinking their warships and hamstringing the elephants. Now, Lysias doesn't do anything to oppose the Romans on this, but his subservience to them, the fact that he allows this to happen to his people, so upsets them that a coup is started by a guy named Demetrius I, who is related by extension to Antiochus. And don't quote me on it, but he's like his cousin or something. So effectively what happens is there's an upheaval in the powers that be, and Judas, sitting down there in Jerusalem, like decides, hey, it's another chance. And so he throws out Alchemist, right? This Syrian-leaning high priest. And so what's Alchemist to do? Well, he goes and he appeals to Demetrius I. Demetrius comes down with a big army, compels Judas to flee the area. Alchemist is reinstated. He murders a bunch of the Kasadim, massacres them, and this causes Judas to send an emissary to Rome, asking for help against these Syrians. After all, back in the day, they had already defeated Antiochus the Great, kind of minimizing the Seleucid influence on the Mediterranean world. 1 Maccabees 8:12 says, "They have subdued kings far and near, and as many as have heard of their fame have feared them." So Judas sends a couple of ambassadors, and here, this is a major, major turning point. Because you know what this does? I mean, Rome's kind of been looking for this opportunity. Yeah, they're the Senate, the defender of the free world, right? Just like us. And so if there's a reason to go in somewhere and maybe leave behind a military commander or five, well, why not? And so what better than a plea from these poor oppressed Jews down in Syria to get Rome to turn its eye in that direction? Now, before this actually comes to pass, I think it's before the ambassadors really even get to Rome, this guy Nicanor, who's been leading troops, trying to find Judas for a while since he gave him that bloody nose way back when, he finally gets Judas to engage him at a place called Adasa on the 13th of Adar in 161 BC. And, well, wouldn't you know, Judas wipes the floor with him and actually kills him this time. But, it's the last victory Judas will ever have. Another army of 20,000 footmen and 2,000 horsemen, that sounds a little more reasonable, besiege Judas at a town called Elassa, north of Jerusalem. And there they kill him. Which means that now the real leader within Israel, Judea, is gone. You still have the family of the Maccabees, and some of them are going to be pretty important here, but you have these Chassidim, right, these holy ones, and you have these Greek sympathizers, Syrian sympathizers. And those Syrian sympathizers are led by this guy Alcimus. So with the death of Judas, you know, now you got this high priest who has quite a bit of influence, loves Greek culture, puts other unbelieving Hellenists into important positions. He actually tears down the partition in the courtyard of the temple between the court of the Jews and the court of the nations. Three of the surviving Maccabean brothers, and they're really not Maccabees, they're Asmodean brothers, right? Mattathian brothers, but they're called Maccabean because they're related to the hammer. The three of them that are left flee beyond the Dead Sea, and in fleeing, one of them is killed, leaving only Jonathan and Simon. And Jonathan, I mean, it's not just the two, right? They've got some men with them, but they're not a large group. But Jonathan, he steps up, and he starts another guerrilla warfare from the wilderness. He kind of hit and strike, run and go, come in, attack, get out of there quick. And he is able to slowly start retaking some territory again. He retook from the Syrians one important stronghold after another until only Jerusalem remained. Now, this is because the Syrian army isn't really there anymore, right? This is like small-time zealotry stuff. And it's enhanced because there's another revolution among the Seleucids. Remember, Demetrius I is not the son of Antiochus. But there's a guy named Alexander Balas, the brother of Antiochus V, son of Antiochus IV. He starts making claims that he should actually be ruling the Seleucid Empire. And he's got some support from some pretty financially strong places. Pergamum, remember Pergamum? It's a place of wealth, right? It's a business town. And they're supporting his claim. And he has the support of Egypt, that's the Ptolemies, right? And Rome. Remember, Rome didn't necessarily come down to help the Jews, but they're looking for reasons to get involved. And Egypt is always looking for reasons to be more involved, taking land from the Seleucids, from the kings of the north. So now suddenly, Demetrius is trying to reach out to this guy, Jonathan, because he wants him to join him and lead the Maccabeans into fighting with him against these other groups. But guess who also reaches out to Jonathan? Oh, yeah. Alexander reaches out to Jonathan. And since Alexander's got Rome's support and they've already appealed to Rome, Jonathan says, I'm with Alexander. They actually get involved in the fight, and Demetrius I is killed. Now, the reward for this is that Jonathan is appointed high priest of Jerusalem. And he's sent a purple robe and a golden crown, making him a sort of strangely typological high priest and king. I mean, he's made the ruler of Jerusalem and Judea, on behalf of the Syrians, on behalf of the Seleucids, on behalf of Rome. So with this, though, you got to recognize he's not a king. Rome didn't really put people into kingdoms. They gave them what we call ethnarchies, right? Ethnarch from the word ethne, ethnic, right? And arche, kind of shoved into ethne. Arche means ruler, ruler of the peoples, ruler of the tribes, ruler of the whatever your skin color is. But not a king. And Jonathan will not call himself a king. And there's a reason for that. Because while he does have the right lineage to be the high priest and offer sacrifices at the Feast of Booths in 153 BC, we're going to come back to that as well. So to put that in your memory bank there. He has the right lineage to be a priest. He does not have the right lineage to be a king. Even less than that which was in Zerubbabel. Right? Zerubbabel was descended from David's line. Jonathan is not. The Maccabeans are not. But he does find himself in a position to help his people and to achieve the goal of the Chassidim, right? Which is to purify the religion of Israel. And so they of course, join him in this endeavor now. Now, it could have gone really poorly because this guy, Alexander, he's not king for long up in the Seleucid Empire. Demetrius II, would you believe it? One of the sons of Demetrius I gets vengeance upon his father's overthrow when Alexander attempts to usurp the throne of Ptolemy down in Egypt by means of his wife's kind of claim to it. Her name's Cleopatra. Now, it's not the one you're thinking of. She's going to come much later. But, you know, he marries this lady named Cleopatra from the Ptolemy line. And the Ptolemaic line is indeed where Cleopatra comes from, the one you're thinking of. So, but this guy Alexander with Cleopatra is trying to throw off Ptolemy, her father, and he fights back, and Demetrius II joins it. Anyway, so Alexander goes down. Now, this could have gone poorly, but Jonathan's, they call this guy the Cunning, right? So he's the brother of the Hammer. His name's the Cunning because he knows how to make use of a good opportunity. So what he does is he uses this time to consolidate his position. He doesn't go crazy and just start attacking everywhere. He starts making sure that what he has, he can hold. And he starts taking strategic cities on the southern side of Jerusalem to again, fortify his position. Which means he's throwing down, you know, pagan altars as he's doing this, which leads the Hellenistic party. This is the Syrian-leaning group of Jews who want to practice false religion. It leads them to appeal to Demetrius II, the guy who just become the emperor again, right? But as soon as Jonathan hears about this, he goes to meet the emperor directly himself. He goes straight to him, which is dangerous. But the guy is so impressed by this one they called the Cunning that he goes ahead and he just reconfirms all the privileges that had already been put upon him and says, yep, you're absolutely in charge. You take care of it, man. So within just a few years, Jonathan Maccabeus, not really, Jonathan Asmoneus, brother of the Hammer, has gone from being a fugitive hiding around the other side of the Dead Sea to being the high priest and ethnarch of Jerusalem, granted extra privileges by the emperor of the Seleucid dynasty. And he gets extra privileges. He's made an arbiter of the Syrian throne, which means he's in international politics. Now, there's a couple of interesting things, but maybe most interesting here is it's amazing that we all probably, even if we don't know the story, we know the name Judas Maccabeus. But it was Jonathan who really, really solidified what is going to become the Asmonean or the Hasmonean dynasty in Judea, where they are going to, not as kings, but as ethnarchs, where they're going to rule for several generations. It wasn't the Hammer, it was the Cunning that got this done. Of course, getting involved in international politics leads to international tragedies. So when another upheaval takes place with the Syrian throne, Jonathan is actually killed by a guy named Trypho. He's basically assassinated. He's invited to dinner and then murdered. At which point, there's still one brother left. His name is Simon. And Simon gives a speech to all of Jerusalem, and it's a rousing enough speech, at least in their hearing, that he is able, with this speech, to unite the three opposing parties, right? The Hellenists, these Greek-Syrian-leaning Jews, the Kasadim, the Holy Ones, and then the Zealotry, the Maccabees, those who are already with him. He manages to unite them, so they respond to him. You are our leader. All that you say to us, we will do. He forms a treaty with Demetrius II, who's still there and still fighting. He says, I'll fight for you. And he pursues then a policy of vengeance and is able to see Trypho killed in battle. After which, Demetrius is so thankful for the help that he releases the Jews from all taxes and grants them political independence, which would effectively make Simon a king. Except that he's not. He's not a king. He doesn't call himself a king because, again, he's not from the line of David. And this is kind of an important little twist. It's going to come back. But meanwhile, in 142 BC, Simon leads a great celebration and procession into the city of Jerusalem. And that's one of the three things that we're going to need to really zoom in on here if we ever get through the history itself, right? The first is the purification of the temple by Judas. The second is the Feast of Booths celebrated by Jonathan. And now this third is a bit of a triumphal procession celebrated by Simon. The three sons of Mattathias, the three Hasmoneans, called Maccabeans, but, you know, they're brothers of Maccabeus the Hammer. And good times ensue. I mean, the land had rest all the days of Simon, 1 Maccabees 14 says. They tilled their land in peace. The ground gave its increase, and the trees of the plains their fruit. Old men sat in the streets. They talked altogether of good things, and the youths donned the glories and garments of war, till his renown spread to the ends of the earth. Each man sat under his vine and his fig tree. You can hear in that language the belief, the hint that the prophecies of old have been fulfilled. That this is God's work, God's hand, God bringing them back to the land and setting them like he said he would do. The only problem is, I've said it now several times, this guy's not from the line of David. Now, he's actually, I think he's got a good mind about this. We found coins that were minted by Simon, and it's very faithful. The coin reads on one side, Jerusalem the Holy. And on the other side, it just is either designated to be a shekel or a half shekel. It's going to be very different from some of his descendants and what they're going to do as they try to hold on to a little more of that power. But for the moment, there is a zeal. There is a belief that this guy as steward is more or less waiting and that soon, the anointed, the son of David will come. And they even start setting about doing some of those holy things you might know the Pharisees for. Like killing sorcerers and whatnot, anybody who's found breaking the law. But Simon, like his brothers, seems ill-fated not to have lived very long. It was only a couple of years, 134 BC, when he was inspecting a fortress on the Jericho plain in attendance of a banquet in his honor that both him and two of his sons were slain by his own son-in-law, Ptolemy, who had hoped to more or less become his successor. It's a real wed-winning Game of Thrones kind of moment there. But while two of his sons are killed, one of them gets away, which sounds a little Game of Thrones-ish as well. A guy named John Hyrcanus, he escapes. And although there's a little turmoil as he tries to get a hold of the throne, he manages to get the throne to keep it secure between, again, the south and the north, Syria and Egypt. They're having their own troubles. And so he actually, over the course of his reign, which is about 30 years, he manages to extend the borders of Israel quite a bit. To the extent that it almost covered all the territory that Solomon had ruled over in the 10th century BC. He has successful wars against both the Samaritans and the Idumeans, making those part of his territory. He tears down the temple of the Samaritans on Mount Gerizim, and he forces the Idumeans to be circumcised, which is interesting because they are descendants of Abraham, as Esauites, that's what an Idumean is, an Edomite, an Esauite. They should have had circumcision, but they lost it, so he brings them back into that. Now, this Idumean connection, this is going to be important for later biblical history. It's not so important to today, but we're going to hit on it briefly anyway. But for all of his skill at working the system, he doesn't really like the Kasidim, right? These holy ones. And this is where these holy ones, they begin to become their own party apart from Jerusalem. They obviously believe in the need of the temple and they want a pure temple, but they see themselves as those who are set apart. So it's really from the reign of John Hyrcanus, you're about 100 years before Jesus, that the Pharisees sort of become distinguished. And that you also have this other group in Jerusalem running the temple, more Hellenistic thinking, the Sadducees, right? And there's one other thing you should know that's a little different about Hyrcanus than his father. Remember, Simon put Jerusalem the Holy on his coins, and Hyrcanus puts his own name. Should tell you a lot. But his reign was prosperous, and he is succeeded by Judah Aristobulus I, even though he tried to give his reign to his wife. But Judah Aristobulus puts his own mom in prison and takes the throne from her. And now he's the first one to start calling himself king. He actually used that word. He was very pro-Greek. He was very pro-Hellenic. So he's very different. So you get the Maccabees effectively within a generation of winning freedom to purify and believe what they believe with their religion. The grandson, right? The grandson is flipping it all back on its head. And put it into practice the very things that had caused his great-great-grandfather Mattathias to kill a man. Yet he does manage to conquer Galilee, put that under his reign, and he ties himself closer and closer to the Sadducees and their liberal direction, so that this Hasmonean dynasty, as it really comes to be known at this point, right? The Maccabean family from the Asmoneans through Mattathias, the Hasmonean dynasty, becomes intimately connected with the Sadducee movement. Now, you'd think a guy who imprisoned his mom to steal the throne for her wouldn't then try to make his wife the one who reigns after his death. He might learn a thing or two, but he doesn't. He does the same thing, and she lets free her brother-in-law, Alexander Janius. That is Aristobulus's brother. And then she marries him, and then they're both king. You know, he still favors the Sadducees. He behaves like a Persian. I mean, not much is really changing, but the soap opera is starting to pick up. It's kind of the same old song and dance, though. The region becomes stronger again. They extend into areas of Philistia where they hadn't been before, into the central Jordan as well. And part of this is because the policemen of the world, the Roman Senate, is in some trouble at this point. You might not know the story, Sulla and Pompey and all that stuff, but that's going on up in Rome. There's a civil war. And so everyone else is kind of, you know, take what you can, while the big brother's not watching over your shoulder. And yet at the same time, he's having increasing trouble from this Pharisaic movement back at home. They actually revolt. It doesn't go so well for them. He ends up killing 6,000 of them. And then another time, after crushing a revolt, I mean, this is awful, he crucifies 800 of them in the middle of a banquet that he's giving for himself and others and a bunch of concubines, right? He's got a whorehouse with people being crucified in it. They're having sex while men are dying torturous deaths. I mean, it's this guy's awful, right? Again, Alexander Janius, grandson of John Hyrcanus. And these guys and their wives, I mean, he dies at age 49 and leaves the same lady who kind of upended his brother's reign and goals for the kingdom by making him king. He leaves her in charge as well. And she reigns. She reigns for about 9 years, the first woman to rule over the Jews in her own right. And it's kind of amazing because while she marries these other two guys who are such Hellenists, she actually favors the Pharisees and gains their support. She frees those that were in prison. Jewish ceremonies that had been neglected were restored by her, and every Israelite was also taxed to help pay for the temple. It's during this time that the Sanhedrin, right, a elder version of the government, kind of the descendant of this idea that Israel has elders that help the ruler, that make political decisions, this group kind of comes into their own at this point, and the Pharisees are a big part of that. And from this point on to the birth of Jesus, they never really relinquish their cultural control of the nation. Even though the Sadducees still control the money in the temple, the Pharisees have the cultural kind of upper hand in all of this. Now, I know this is a lot of name dropping, right? But we're getting really close to some names you're going to know. So while Alexandra is ruling as queen, the one thing she lost in this was being both, well, king and high priest, right? You have these guys calling themselves kings. They've been the rulers. They're also the high priest. They're in the lineage of the priest, not the lineage of the kings. She's now ruling, but she can't be the high priest. Got to have a guy for that. Remember, she likes the Pharisees. Pharisees play nice with her and all that. So her eldest son, Hyrcanus II, is doing that. And as she gets ready to basically die, she wants him to become king as well. So, you know, a nice little lineage thing. But Hyrcanus II is kind of weak. He's not ambitious at all. And so his brother, Aristobulus II, well, as soon as it happens, as soon as the transition happens, he basically steals the throne from him, defeats him, and forces him to abdict his position as both priest and king. And this would have gone well for him if there had not been someone else who had his own ambitions in all of this, and seeing the weakness of Hyrcanus II, decided to come to his aid as an advisor in scare quotes, right? This guy's name was Antipater, and he was the regional governor of Idumea, right? The Edomites, the Idumeans. He's the guy that on behalf of the king is ruling that area, and he comes to Hyrcanus II's aid. And they do pretty well. They end up besieging Jerusalem again. At this time, because there's a civil war at this point going on between the two, both of them say, hey, let's appeal to Rome. Uh-oh, wait a minute. Hasn't Rome been ignoring us for a while? Yep, so let's get them back in. Let's see if we can get them in control again, because that's kind of what happens. But they both want power, so they're trying to hold on. And this time when Rome comes back, they're never going to leave again. They hadn't really left entirely. I mean, there's a treaty and all, but this time they're gonna stick around. I mean, Pompey has defeated Sulla. The triumvirate between Caesar and Pompey and Crassus has been formed. And although there's a lot of politicking going on and you're going to have an issue between Pompey and Caesar come up, Rome's as strong as it's really ever been. They are running the Mediterranean. Mithridates VI is done over on the east side. He had kind of been this king of the rest of Persia, right? So the Seleucids had like the Syria Persia and the Babylon Persia. This guy is everything east of Turkey, which is, it went quite a ways. And there's a lot of money there. This guy was so wealthy. And the fight between him and Rome is really kind of interesting because Rome has been trying to take out a number of different Mithridates for a while. And this one, though, they finally are able to win that. So when they do turn their eyes south, it is a permanent turn south toward enhancing their own control. Pompey himself sends a general down as his emissary to meet with both Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. They both offer him bribes, and he accepts the bigger bribe, which happens to be from Aristobulus, right? Not from Antipater and Hyrcanus. But it's only kind of a temporary thing, too. Just a year later, Pompey summons them both to Rome, and he's going to decide himself, and he does decide in favor of Hyrcanus II. Aristobulus flees to Jerusalem, and this is when you get Pompey besieging Jerusalem, right? This great general of the Roman Republic coming down to go up against this city that so often has had the powers of the world come against it. It's happening again. The siege lasts 3 months, and when it finally is captured, 12,000 Jews have died. Remember, we're talking, I mean, does it sound familiar yet? Tribulation, great tribulation. It's over and over again. Pompey himself marches into the Holy of Holies in the temple, which is a really terrible thing. Some people would say this is the abomination of desolation. Again, I'm going to say it was when Antiochus IV did his work. But the end result is that Hyrcanus II finds himself high priest and ethnarch, right? Not king, but ruler of the lands. Only now it's a bit less lands. All those extra territories that had been conquered, well, now they become dependent provinces of Rome. But, you know, something else happens. I mean, it's amazing that Pompey did all this. Did he think that Hyrcanus II was weak? Because he was weak. And then he goes and he makes Antipater the governor of Judea itself. I mean, this means that you have an Edomite ruling Judea. A son of Esau has inherited the land. And you kind of know where this is going. Have you put it together yet? Antipater turns out to be pretty good at politics, and so while reigning over Judea, while continuing to gain favor with Caesar as he comes into power in Rome, he also raises his boys to know the game. And he makes one of his boys the governor of Galilee. That guy's name was Herod, and Herod does well. He breaks up a robber gang that had infested that area. He captures their leaders. He has them all executed. He gets in trouble with the Sanhedrin because he's taken the death penalty onto himself. So what does he do? Good Idumean that he is. He appeals to a guy named Sextus Caesar, who's just the Roman proconsul for Syria. This guy Sextus, he hears what the problem is, and he's like, wait a minute. They're all mad because you killed the robbers that were tyrannizing everybody? Here you go. Let me put you in control of more stuff. There you go. Here's a promotion. And you know that guy, right? I mean, it's 35 plus years before Jesus, but he's going to be an old man clinging tightly to the throne about the time Jesus is born. So, again, I dropped a lot of names, right? There's tons of names here, and I don't expect you to remember all of it, but hopefully you got this much of the picture. The Seleucid Empire, one quarter of Alexander the Great's conquering of everything, leads to this little horn named Antiochus IV, right, of Daniel's prophecy, who creates a real problem for faithful Jews that leads to a rebellion led by a family traditionally now called the Maccabees. And that family has three boys who survive long enough to really do some good so far as the nation state of Israel is concerned, including three festivals that we're going to come back to in just a second. But as a result of their success, they end up becoming closer and closer to a king. Now, none of them actually use the name king, but they get really close to being king. So that the first generation later, one generation later, you have an heir to the throne who is treating the very guys who were fighting for you to make all this happen, the purifiers, treating them poorly. And one more generation later, and you got a guy in place doing the exact same stuff that you were rebelling against in the first place, fearlessly calling himself king. And it's only about a generation and a half, two generations later, that the heir is so weak that his brother tries to take it from him, and in order to make it work out, in order to hold on, he needs the help of both Caesar and Pompey and Antipater, the father of Herod the Great. And just like that, you've gone, well, you've gone all the way, right? From Daniel to Jesus. And at the very least, you can now figure out why no one likes Herod. I mean, everyone didn't like Herod because he's had a cruel reign, but the guy, as an Edomitian, as an Edomite, remember, the Edomites are those, I think I just said this, the Edomites are those who joined forces with Babylon to conquer Jerusalem back when it was destroyed to the ground before. The Edomites are the descendants of Esau that have never been friendly to the Hebrews. And now here you have this guy named Herod pretending to be and being called king of the Jews. He is a son of Abraham, but he is not a son of Judah and not an heir in the line of David, which is why he is terrified when those magi come from the east. Yeah? But now, okay. So all of this is really to give us the context for these three events that we want to look more closely at. That after Judas Maccabeus, after Judas the Hammer conquers Jerusalem, takes it from the hand of Lysias, he says to his brothers, look, our enemies have been demolished. Let us go cleanse the sanctuary. That's what the entire point of this thing was, right? They wanted to get the temple back. So all of the army goes up to Mount Zion. And they see that the temple is desolated, right? The altar has been profaned. The gates are burned down. There are bushes growing in the courtyards. There's a thicket. The chambers of the priests lie in total ruins. And seeing this all, they rend their garments, right? Which as priests, they're probably not supposed to do according to the law. But again, this is a time when the law isn't exactly as known as it should be. They're zealous for it, but they don't really know it. They rip their garments, and they go and they choose some other priests, those who have not necessarily, you know, defiled their hands with bloodshed. And they began working on cleaning the sanctuary. And it's not just spick and span here. We're talking about purification, the ritual purification from Old Testament Levitical codes. They remove the defiled stones to an unclean place. And they take the altar, which they know has been desecrated, and they take it down. And I actually kind of love this part. They store the stones somewhere safe, far away, where it's unclean, until a prophet would come and tell them what to do with them. They're still waiting for what they know is supposed to be there, right? And you got two things here. You got, look how zealous and truthfully faithful they are. Look how misguided they are. Look how fast it all falls apart. It's kind of like the moral of the story here. But they take whole new stones then, as the law directs, and they build a new altar just like the former one, and then do the same for the rest of the sanctuary. They make new holy vessels, a new lampstand, new altar of incense, a new table for the temple. They place new bread of the presence on the table, they hang up new curtains, and then early in the morning on the 25th day of the 9th month, which is the month of Chislev, which is the same day that the sanctuary had originally been profaned, they purify the sanctuary officially with a rite, with a ritual, with a festival, with a feast. And there's a couple things you got to keep in mind here. One is they haven't had any of these for like over a year now, year plus. No Passover, that was in the early springtime. No Feast of Weeks, that was in the later springtime, early summer. No Feast of Booths and Day of Atonement, Day of Purification. That was in the fall, the harvest time. It's now winter, late fall, December. First Maccabees tells us in chapter 4, early in the morning on the 25th day, they rose and offered sacrifice as the law directed with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. All the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed heaven. So they celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days and offered whole burnt offerings with gladness. Now, 8 days, that doesn't tell you everything you need to know, but see, thankfully, there's a second Maccabees, chapter 10. Where it says, it happened on the same day on which the sanctuary had been profaned by the foreigners, the purification of the sanctuary took place, that is, on the 25th day of the same month, which was Chislev. And they celebrated it for 8 days with rejoicing in the manner of the Feast of Booths, remembering how not long before, during the Feast of Booths, they had been wandering in the mountains and caves like wild animals. Therefore, bearing ivy-wreathed wands and beautiful branches and... wait for it. You've been waiting like for 3 episodes. Wait for it. And fronds of palm. They offered hymns and thanksgiving to him who had given success to the purifying of his own holy place. Now, if you talk to any Jew today, this is Hanukkah. But see, Hanukkah, Festival of Lights, it's got some new practices. They didn't keep the palms. The palms are part of the Feast of Booths, but it was part of the first Hanukkah. It's the part of the reclamation of the holiness of the temple, right? Kind of keep that in the back of your mind. And then let's keep going forward here, because while this happens here like this, as a key point in the Maccabean story, after Judas dies, remember there's this guy Alcimus who gets made high priest. Joachim was his name, right? Alcimus. And he's a Hellenist, and he starts putting like pagan practitioners back into the temple. And so things aren't so good for a while until Jonathan the Cunning, who is living off by the Dead Sea, right? You know, almost dead. Within a couple of years, he becomes king and high priest. And in 153 BC, what does he do again? Now, we know this from history more than from Maccabees, but he celebrates the Feast of Booths, and it's a big moment. It's a rededication. He offers legal offerings, and the Kasidim party join him permanently at that time. What would have been there according to the law as Jonathan was doing all of this, as this king and high priest was doing all this? So there would have been a whole bunch of palm branches in the air. But then remember how Jonathan is assassinated by Trypho? And then succeeded by his brother Simon, who gets all the groups to unite together to go avenge his death. And after he joins with Demetrius II and puts down Trypho and gains independence for all of Judea, Simon returns to the citadel of Jerusalem in the second month of the year, which is called Iyar, in which there are no festivals or feasts particularly appointed for the Hebrews, but which is in the April-June area, which is... You know, it's really close to that Passover Feast of Weeks. It's like right between those two things. But in that month, he goes back to the citadel of Jerusalem. And he and all the people with him, 1 Maccabees 13:51, they enter the city with praise and, wait for it, palm branches. With harps and cymbals and stringed instruments, with hymns and songs, because a great enemy had been crushed and removed from Israel. And Simon decreed that every year they should celebrate this day with rejoicing. So that when Jesus of Nazareth, on a day to start the feast of Passover, enters the city of Jerusalem, and people hear about it, and they come out to meet him mounted on that colt, that foal of a donkey. And they take palm branches. And they cry out, "Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord, even the King of Israel." There is a reason for this. They've been waiting for a long time for this. All that history, all those false kings, all those pretenders to piety and religion, all the holy ones who were going to make it right, all of the Syrian sympathizers who were going to bring us into the modern age, all of the attempts to purify this temple once and for all and bring about the reign of David, all of the hope that they would be able to keep the feasts as the right demand. The fact that they're waving palm branches at the wrong festival is a dead set giveaway. That they believe that everything that the Maccabees tried to do, Jesus is about to do. Everything that has to do with casting off that great tribulation under which the oppressor's rod has been on their back since the day the Lord spit them out of the land, Jesus is about to do. So they wave those palms, drawn from the Leviticus Feast of Booths, through the rebellion of the Maccabees and their victories over the pagan powers of the world to this moment, to declare that Jesus is the fulfillment of all of it. And they shout, "Save us. Save us. Save us." And did you know that it's only the Apostle John who records that they were palm branches. The others just call them leafy fronds. It's only John that tells you that it's palms. And did you know? Yeah, you did. You know. That the only other time the word palm is used of a tree branch in the entire New Testament is by this same Apostle John in Revelation chapter 7, when a host that no one can number or count, who have been made clean in the blood of the Passover lamb, confused Passover with the Feast of Tabernacles, the Feast of coming out of Egypt into the Promised Land, the Feast of the end of the tribulation, they confuse it once again. And shout, "Salvation belongs to our God who sits on the throne and to the Lamb," as they sing with white robes as their clothing and palm branches in their hands. Now, here's the thing. I don't think that was my best work. I loved the story. I wanted to share it. It's so complicated. I think I had to rely on the notes a lot more than I wanted to. And I'm afraid that, you know, if you got through it, if you listen this long, you're like, man, that was just a bunch of name dropping and it all went too fast. I didn't get anything out of it. So I really pray. I really hope that's not what happened. And this experiment of doing a podcast and trying to bring you good storytelling from all over the Bible in the book of Revelation, you know, it's a hit or miss thing. So hopefully, at the very least, I mean, you know where the palm branches come from now, right? I mean, that's kind of a key thing. It's something I had no idea about before I started this little adventure just with this episode. And so I'm excited to know it now. Next time there's a Palm Sunday, I might be just a little less hesitant to take that single leaf of palm, which I still think is pretty lame. We should have real palms. But I think I'll be a little less hesitant. I want to grab this thing. I want to wave this thing. I want to say, hey, this is the sign of coming out of darkness and into light at the hand of God's Messiah. This is the sign of the king and the priest come into his own. This is the sign of prophecy from Leviticus chapter 23, verses 33 through 44. A statute forever throughout all generations, that you may know that I made the people Israel to dwell in tents, in booths, in tribulation, while I was bringing them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Lord your God.
Was that worth a dollar? What about five? If so, Pastor Fisk and his family would love to have it, in part to pay for technology and paperwork to keep Rev Fisk Raw going, and in part to just enjoy a night out together. Pledging $1.25 on Patreon, only $5 a month, lets the worker know his labor is appreciated. And if you're a true fan, you can give even more. You can find the link to Patreon in the show notes and check out the other giving levels there, including advertising your product, your family, or your congregation on Rev Fisk Raw. Lock and load, then rock on.